Let's debunk the biggest myths about cryonics. What are the most common misconceptions, do you think?
Sure. So, I mean, we're working on, you know, correcting these misconceptions, right? And at least in some countries, I think in Europe here, I think we've been more and more successful of at least making some amount of headway here. I think traditionally, the biggest misconception, at least in the broader audience, is always that this is freezing. But which it was in the past, right? So, you know, by now, decades ago, but initially this was just freezing bodies, and then, you know, fingers crossed it's going to work in the future. But I think this myth is slightly perpetuated by the fact that most journalists that we talk to in most headlines are still calling it freezing, because it's a very clear visual impression, right? And so we're very, very adamant when we talk to journalists that, hey, you know, it's not freezing. In fact, we do. And this is kind of the only reason why it's slightly annoying to me if it's called freezing, because a good chunk of what we do is to avoid freezing. It's not like, you know, it's not technically correct. It's in fact, we work actively against freezing. I think this is one big misconception. And probably the biggest. Another one is definitely that it's unaffordable, right? It's like, you know, meaning that I think if people are not too involved in the topic, people think it's like millions or a million, right? So significantly more expensive. I'm not saying cryopreservation is cheap, but significantly more expensive than it actually is. Should I go on? There's probably a couple more.
Yeah, well, how much is it roughly, especially at your company, compared to what people think? You said it was millions, but how much is it compared to the...
They think it is millions. It is not millions. So it is, on average, it's somewhere around 200,000 euros, right? And that includes A to Z. You don't need to pay anything else. That is it, right? No more future payments or anything like that. It's a one-time fee of 200,000. Again, still not cheap, but definitely not millions. And last but not least, of course, most people, they don't wire us the money when they sign up. In fact, almost no one does.
So we were discussing about how it's not freezing, cryopreservation. What is it instead? I've heard the term vitrification. Is that correct?
Yeah. Yeah, that is in fact the totally correct term. That is the technical term. So vitrification means basically a phase transition from into a glass-like amorphous state, right? And of course, the trick here being freezing means ice crystal formation, right? Where you have sharp ice crystals and a variety of other types of damage. If you vitrify, go into this glass-like state, you avoid all this crystallization, and by that you get preservation quality that, if you warm it up fast enough, at least in simple terms, you would in theory regain viability and the tissue still works. Whereas if it's freezing, the tissue would be, you know, not necessarily destroyed, but at least by current standards it would not be viable. So it is exactly that. It is an ice free cryopreservation, a vitrification, or like this glass-like, in a glass-like amorphous state preservation.
Yeah. So instead of turning people into ice, you're kind of turning them into glass, right?
Pretty much. Exactly. Like, and then the goal would be in the future. And this is, of course, so in cells, you can do this right now. So cell preservation, be it for in vitro fertilization, where you cryopreserve egg cells, or sperm, or in the lab, basically being done every day with a lot of different cell lines, they use the same technology. They vitrify those cells, which then allows them to be rewarmed and, basically while the cell survives. And now, of course, in our case, you would do that with much larger volumes. You can do it even with small organs right now, but humans are not yet possible to at least bring back. You can bring them into this vitrified state. You can show that the quality at that vitrified state is good. What you cannot yet do is you cannot yet bring them back from that vitrified state. And that, hopefully, fingers crossed, in the future will be possible at some point.
Yeah, I've read that during that process of vitrification, is the blood removed and then replaced with a different fluid? Could you tell me a bit more about that?
Yeah, in fact, it is. So not only the blood, but also the basically all the water in the body. So one of the ways why we don't freeze is because the blood is placed in the water as well against a so-called cryoprotective agent, which is pretty much a medical grade antifreeze solution, a solution that even with very, very low temperatures, in our case, at least negative 140 degrees, many cases negative 196 degrees, does not freeze. Now, that is the core logic of it, that the water that would otherwise form ice crystals is not there anymore, or partially it's still there, but at least it's in so small concentration that it doesn't freeze.
And is it true that when you cryopreserve someone, they haven't actually fully died? Because I always thought you kind of just, someone died, they were gone, they were deceased, and then you just like froze them. But what's the misconception there? What is the actual case?
There's not that much of a misconception actually in that. So the people who get cryopreserved, they are, by all current medical and legal standards, they are dead. In fact, cryopreservation can only be done once someone has legally been pronounced dead. Right, for a variety of course, ethical and so on, and medical reasons, cryopreservation is not a medical procedure. It is a donation for the long term, for cryopreservation, basically, based on a body donation contract that can only be executed once that person has legally been pronounced. So what does happen is, so the person's heart stops at some point, right? They might have a terminal condition, let it be cancer or heart disease or what. Doesn't matter, or organ failure. Once their heart stops, based on where you are, you know, the US and Europe and specific countries, different countries have different rules of under which circumstances you can pronounce legal death. That happens after the heart stops, and then cryopreservation can start after that has happened, after that legal pronouncement. So they're not preserved, you know, while they're alive or anything like that. Now, the logic being that there's a certain amount of time, you know, if my heart would stop right now because, you know, I don't know, have a heart attack, or I don't know what it might be, but there's a certain amount of, at room temperature, at body temperature, a certain amount of minutes, if EMTs or doctors would come and do chest compressions and give oxygen and all of that, right, they would be able to revive me. Somewhere, you know, 6 minutes, 8 minutes, and so on, like a couple of minutes. And now, cryopreservation, the logic is that in that time frame, where in theory, if you would do it, right, let's say someone dies due to cancer, right, their heart stops, the person is pronounced, and then in that time frame, where in theory their body would still be able to support life, bar the cancer, of course, right, and of course that's why you don't try to resuscitate them, because they would just die in another hour later because of the organ failure or whatever. The underlying reason due to the cancer is, in that time, you cool down the whole body and you stop all the degradation processes once you're at these cryogenic temperatures. And now the plan, of course, or the hope or the prediction would be that in the future, at some point, the underlying condition that led to the patient's death, in this case, the cancer, would be curable. And then you could, in theory, resuscitate that person and then they might live happily ever after. And of course, no one does that because they say, hey, listen, I just want to be cryopreserved tomorrow. People only and exclusively do this because they say, I have a terminal condition and my choice is, I have two choices. I can either be cryopreserved or I can be cremated or buried. And then based on the personal, worldview of people who choose that, in almost all cases, In their mind, you know, if they're buried or cremated, that's it. There's no coming back from that. The probability of coming back from that is zero.
Yeah.
And now, at the very least, and that's the only strong statement I'm willing to make, at the very least, cryopreservation has a better probability. I can't say how much better, but I'm very confident it's better than cremation. So one thing, when I give talks, I'm saying, listen, you have two choices, right? You know, if you're not signed up for cryopreservation, you have implicitly signed up for cremation or burial. But to be fair, not much difference between those two. So you can choose between cryo or burial. And this is a choice that everybody, either explicitly or implicitly needs to make. And if someone says, hey, I'd rather be cremated, totally fine, right? And it's an individual choice. But if someone says, I'd rather be cryopreserved, then of course I would say, well, I very much understand that. And of course, for me personally, the choice is very clear.
Yeah. And what kind of inspired you to go down this route? Because at one point you were doing some entrepreneurship and you were studying cancers and stuff like that. So what made you switch to cryopreservation?
I studied medicine and then went into research because I wanted to go into longevity research. So longevity has always been like this idea that, you know, in the best case scenario, I'm going to die when I'm 90 in good health, or without having a lot of morbidity, a lot of like low quality of life before death. That's the best case scenario, right? So this was never something that I particularly looked forward to, right? So I would like to see how the future looks like 200 years from now, 300, 500 years from now, right? A, because I like life. I enjoy almost every day. I definitely, on average, I very much enjoy life. I'm definitely curious what the future might bring and what technology we might have and whatever, you name it. Like, it's very difficult to predict. So dying was never a particularly great idea, I felt. And also I'm emotionally, I don't like the idea of death. Like, it's something that scares me to a good amount. So, and then I went into longevity. Unfortunately, I never felt like the longevity field is progressing fast enough. And over time, and not saying they don't make progress, definitely do make progress, but it's not fast enough. So, and fast enough mostly for how many years of life left I have and a lot of other people have that are currently alive. And then, of course, we always need to be aware there's a tremendous amount of people who are dying right now, even if in 10 years we might solve cancer and all the other age-related diseases. Until that point, you know, millions and hundreds of millions of people will have died. So because of all of that together, I said, hey, listen, like, cryopreservation is the only thing that I'm currently aware of that would give me a shot if either I get some early terminal condition or if the longevity field in fact does not progress fast enough, and then I'm 85 at some point dying of cancer and I definitely don't want to be dead. So all of these things together, I said, listen, I'm willing to work on that. And yeah, since then I have.
Yeah. And in terms of the cancer and the medical research and stuff like that, why do you think it is much slower than you'd hoped it to be?
So there's a couple of reasons. So first of all, even within cancer research, it is slower than the predictions of the past. And the reason for that is just cancer, and then on a higher level, biology in general, is just very, very complex. And, you know, when the genome was sequenced like many years ago by now, the predominant opinion while it was being sequenced and where we thought, hey, we have this soon, was now we will cure all the diseases because now we have the book, we have the code now, right? Then it turned out, of course, well, unfortunately, it's much, much more. We have the book, but we don't understand it, right? It's much, much more complex than we think it is. Longevity per se, longevity in itself has some additional issues, right? Like, the most important one, that there might be interventions that someone would need to start taking when they're, let's say, 40, 50, 60s, right? But then you need to wait for argument's sake, 20, 30, 40 years potentially to see if this actually works. And now running clinical trials that are that long is just very, very difficult. It's very costly. So just inherently, it's very difficult to make that work. And then I think it has a few more additional problems. One being that a lot of people who have a background in computer science and engineering and like startups went into the field of longevity and came with the expectation that the innovation cycles that they're used to from the tech world will be similar in medicine and biotech. And unfortunately, it turned out, well, they're not, right? They're significantly longer and it's more complex and less tangible. So I never argue that there is no progress. There is progress. I'm arguing that progress is not anywhere close to where our predictions were, right? And, you know, the cancer field has been saying for many decades, it's just another 10 years that cancer will be cured, right? And now the longevity field says, like, you know, in 10 years, we might have big breakthroughs. And if they do, I'm going to be the first one who's going to be absolutely happy about it and congratulate them and say, listen, guys, I was wrong. Now just tell me what it costs to do whatever you have figured out. Right. So I'm going to be very happy about that. I just think it's very unlikely that there will be tremendous breakthroughs. And whenever I say that, I mean a bar if there's like super AI coming about anytime soon, right? If very strong AI, either it be very narrow AI, but very, very powerful, or super artificial intelligence, then of course all my predictions go out of the window anyway. But if that's not the case anytime soon, so I think I'm on track to be 85 at some point and then still need to be cryopreserved for a while until the rest of society has figured out how to, there's enough time. And this is, again, what cryopreservation gives you. The only thing it gives you time. It gives you time to bridge the time until medical research, biological research, and so on has figured out how to do it.
So why aren't people, why isn't it all like everywhere? You know, like no one's talking about it other than, well, maybe they are, but in terms of my life, like all I thought was, some people are getting frozen. Some like crazy people are getting frozen. Then I do some research on it. I'm like, whoa, this is actually like legitimate. Why is it not being pushed? And why aren't more people signing up for cryopreservation?
It's a very good question. And I think we still don't fully understand it. We understand it then better than I did in the past. And so our organization, we grow somewhere between 10 and 20 times faster than our next competitor. Is kind of the wrong word, like, because we're not really competitors. Like, this is a very small field, so everybody's kind of friends with each other. But like the next organization that also offers something in the same value proposition direction. So we kind of have figured it out, I think, better how to communicate this topic. But then again, it's like we're now getting towards 1,000 people signed up, right? We're not there yet. We're like in a couple of months, we will have 1,000 people signed up. Negligible amounts, right? So I think it's a combination of a multitude of different things. So if you're young, so the people who usually sign up for cryopreservation are two types of people. On one hand, it's somewhere between 35 and 45, people who are absolutely healthy. And also we also have 30-year-olds and 25-year-olds, but I think 38, I think, is the average. They sign up because they say, this makes sense. I'm totally healthy. I just want to have this as a backup.
Yeah.
For most people, though, it is, and I think this is probably the biggest issue. It always feels like something, even if you want to do it, even if you said, hey, listen, if I get a terminal condition tomorrow, I'd rather be cryopreserved. It's my choice is to be cryopreserved instead of being cremated. If you're healthy, you always feel like, well, I might just do this in 10 years. It's like the thing how most people don't have last wills. And at a certain age, you probably should have a last will. Definitely when you have children, you should have a last will. But it always feels like I might as well do this tomorrow, next week, next month, next year. Right? And then we have a good amount of people who sign up with us who have been thinking, not only thinking, they have decided 10 years ago. Right? Mm-hmm. And so I think it's that. Then, of course, there's still a good amount of people who think, I've heard about this in science fiction, but I don't know that, I'm not aware that it's a tangible thing that you can actually do. And then I think these two things are the large chunk. And then for people who are old right now, let's say you're 85 right now, then statistically speaking, you had your last 20 years of your life were potentially not with the greatest quality of life. So, and I think people who are old right now, there might be a good chunk, not everybody, of course, but there might be a good chunk who would say, listen, this quality of life that I've experienced for the last, I don't even want to go on for that long. I'm kind of okay with dying. And now, it seems to me that if you look at the trajectories, how much more people gain health span when they're old, that in the future there will be more and more 85-year-olds or 90-year-olds or whatever who just came back from the hiking or sailing or golf or whatever they do trip, and then the doctor tells them that they have a terminal condition and they have 6 months to live. So I think in the future there will be significantly more people who would say, listen, no, what? I'd rather live longer, right? And And I would rather be cryopreserved because I didn't experience this long, low quality of life. But then again, in the end, I understand why not everybody does it, but I still don't understand why that few people do it. So it's still something that we're in the process of figuring out and, of course, learning how to communicate this topic so that people think about it and make it a conscious decision if they want to do it or not.
Yeah,
I think this is the one thing.
Yeah. It's just that I don't think a lot of people, I think people are just ignorant to it. There's just an indifference. There's not necessarily a cynicism about it. There might be, but I think it's just indifference, really. And I think maybe, I don't know how prevalent cryonics is on social media. Is your company and other companies trying to push the message more and teach people?
More, yes. But so I think it's indifference, or like it's not. So in fact, we know. So we ran like large studies in Europe and in the US. So we asked, like, you know, this is cryopreservation. How many people are you interested? And 26% of population says, this is what I want to do. Of population, 26%. It's tremendous. And then if you ask them, like, hey, you know, should this be illegal or whatever, that's like 1% or 2% say that, right? Like, so most people are either A, very open to it, like a large chunk, not a majority, but like a very relevant minority says, like, you know, 25% or like a fourth, a bit more than a fourth of people say, this is something I want to do. Should I die, right? So it's more so that, you know, if you can do this in the future and then you might not like it anymore once you get low quality of life. And yes, we do, of course. And, you know, we do social media, we do outreach, right? But it's a small field, right? So we're being, you know, drowned out by, you know, the other supplement longevity companies or whatever that are just like, I don't know, there's probably 100x as many as we are. So it's still a kind of like a niche topic where you don't get that much exposure to. But we're working on it.
I feel like in the future, it might be the next big thing, even though it's been around for so long. In terms of on social media, maybe that's the next like health hack. It's like actually just cryopreservation. It would make sense logically in a way.
I of course would say so. No, absolutely. We're working on it.
Yeah. Good. I know you don't want to make predictions, but if you had a timeline for when the first successful revival is for cryopreservation, when do you think it would be?
Yeah, as a disclaimer, I don't know, right? So predictions are always easy or possible if it's kind of like a linear, you know, when you can predict something linear that you have seen. Whereas here, there is a couple of like relatively fundamental paradigm, technologically paradigm shifts necessary. So it's more so that it's not gonna be years, it's not gonna be 10 years, it's not gonna be 20 years. I mean, maybe, you know, an off chance that something happens and now we suddenly everything works, right? Like one of these off chances would be super AI, for example, but maybe also something less drastic. My guess would be somewhere maybe between 50 and 100 years. But to be fair, like, you know, saying 50 years in my mind, there's no difference between saying 50, 100, 150, 200 years. It's so far in the future, right, that a good chunk of things, you know, when you go 50 years back, no one could have imagined iPhones. It's not so that iPhones are just a bit better than the phones they had back then. It is something fundamentally different, right? And if you go 100 years back, then there's things where just fundamentally we can almost not imagine them. And now the day-to-day practice, right? MRIs and these types of things, right? So, and since a couple of those types of things are necessary for cryopreservation, there's a book by Robert Freyers, like a nanotechnology expert, like a very, like it's a great book, not an easy read. It's like a 700 page long paper, basically, very, very detailed, who have written about, okay, how would cryopreservation revival work? How could we make this work with technology that we can currently imagine? So if someone wants to dig super deep, that's definitely something I would recommend. Where at least conceptually we have an understanding of how this might work. But of course there's relatively advanced nanobots basically, you know, that would do things that we can imagine it, but we would not really know how to build them yet, or like we're not close to actually building them. So this is kind of, so it's more so, you know, where like 100 years ago, we could imagine flying to the moon, even though we didn't really, well, 100 or like whatever, how much do you want to go back in the time? It doesn't really matter. Where, you know, you had in science fiction books back then, you had the idea, the concept, right? But of course, it was far away of how from, you know, any shot of actually making it work. And I would say we're currently kind of in that stage in cryopreservation, which would mean maybe somewhere between 50 and 100 years. But again, take this as highly speculative and definitely not something I would say has any strong, you know, fundamental backing or like, you know, yeah.
But it's within the fundamental laws of physics, right? As far as we're aware, like,
as far as we're aware, absolutely. Like, so, and this is kind of why sometimes, you know, people when they want to, like, sometimes I talk to journalists and then they talk to someone who wants to critique it, right? And these people usually then say, this is not possible fundamentally. Hmm. And sometimes I talk to the journalists and say, listen, like, the other person has just made the strongest statement that I've ever made, right? I didn't make any strong statements here. Saying something is fundamentally not possible, you need pretty strong evidence to make that claim, right? Because again, planes 300 years ago were not imaginable.
Yeah.
Now they're day to day, right? So again, I'm not making any prediction of how fast this will go, but fundamentally, I'm not aware of anything why this should not work. As far as we currently understand, personality, identity, you know, consciousness, all of that stuff is encoded in our brains, in the connections of the neurons, in the weights of those connections, potentially some internal computation of the cells. We actually recently published a paper where we asked like 200 something neuroscientists, like, what are the parts that are required for memory? And there was, you know, it wasn't total consensus of what's required, but there's definitely a consensus that certain things are required, right? And on the edges, it becomes a bit fuzzy. Like, some people think stuff is important, but none of that stuff is outside the laws of physics, where someone says, like, you know, there's something that, I don't know, like, you know, like, there's nothing metaphysical that we currently, based at least on our understanding, is required for anything of what we value, personality, identity, memories, consciousness, and all of that, right? So, and in a good cryopreservation, that stuff that we currently understand makes you you and makes me me, that stuff is being kept around. And then I would argue, for all intents and purposes, in theory, you are being kept around. Of course, this is an absolute oversimplification. But then again, you know, once you're in cryopreservation, if it takes 50 years or let it be 100 years or let it be 200 years in the end, it does not matter. Like, you can stay in cryopreservation pretty much for indefinite time frames until it's figured out. Well, yeah, and of course, for you, right? For you, it's going to feel like a second. Well, not even that, right? Like, for you, while you're in cryopreservation, it's not like you need to wait for 200 years, right?
Yeah.
You're just going to, you know, you're going to open your eyes, for argument's sake, and then someone tells you it has been X years. But
yeah, that's scary and exciting. It's almost like a...
it's better like that. Like, it would be worse if you would be somehow 200 years in something. Like, I think it's nicer this way around.
I mean, it's almost like be coming out going under than coming back out of general anesthetic.
I think this is the closest experience that you can currently have, where you know, I've never been under general anesthesia, so I don't speak I somehow avoided all hospitals, luckily, at least for anything more serious. So basically, where, you know, we have these stories where people wake up from general anesthesia, right? And then I ask the doctors, like, when are we starting? And the doctor's like, listen, 8 hours have passed, we're already done, right? Because you have no experience of time during that period, right? So I think it would be the closest I think you can currently experience.
Yeah, I've gone under it about a year and a half ago now, for an ankle operation. And I remember them putting stuff in my arms, my heart rate was going up. And then I just like kind of wake up like, oh, like not like when it started, but like it just woken up from like nothing. Yeah. There was no dreaming, there was nothing. It was end of the memory, start of a new memory, nothing in between, which is quite scary, but also very cool.
Totally. Like, no, very scary. Absolutely. Like, but it would be close to that, probably, waking up from cryopreservation, just that now years, decades, if not centuries have passed.
Is it a innovation and engineering problem right now then, like to revive someone and to get the cures for cancer, to increase the rate of innovation in nanotechnology and biomedicine? Is that the fundamental problem? So it's not a physics problem, it's an engineering and kind of manufacturing problem.
Yeah, I mean, it is a physics problem. It's not a physics problem that we need new physics for it. It's a physics problem as in that heat exchange is a physics topic, right? So not as in we need new physics. In that regard, it is probably mostly an engineering and innovation challenge. Some research, of course, required, like, you know, for nanotech, there's like a couple of things that we just currently can't do. And of course, for other topics as well. Yeah, so that this is, I think, by and large, it is by and large an engineering problem.
And you mentioned kind of the rewarming process. What some like maybe more specific or big, like the biggest challenges currently cryopreservation is facing in rewarming and reviving dead people?
So again, like putting someone in cryopreservation under good logistical conditions and so on, you can do pretty well. The rewarming is, so it's not like, we cannot currently wake people up because the quality is somehow too bad. At least it doesn't look like that's the case. It's the problem that we cannot warm up without accumulating lots of damage during warm up. And of course we can also not cure cancer, but that aside. So the issue is that these cryoprotective agents of which we spoke, these medical grade antifreezes, they only stop ice crystal formation if you cool very fast and warm very fast. Basically, a physical property of how ice crystal formation works, that you need to cool down with, you know, 0. something degrees per minute. And then you cool down fast enough to not have ice crystal formation. But to warm up, you need to warm up in a couple of degrees to tenths of degrees to ideally hundreds of degrees per minute.
Wow.
So warming, of course, is always a heat exchange problem. You want to get heat away, or in warming up cases, you want to put heat everywhere, right? And now this everywhere point is the problem. You cannot do it on the outside. Of course, you can warm up the outside super fast, but you know the outside is gone already. Like, you know, if you put something into a microwave, right, and the outside is already burning, and the inside is still a clump of ice, right? So you need to do it uniform. And you need to do it uniform and fast. And now this is where the problem comes from, where you need to deposit energy, warming energy, inside the brain, inside all of the body. And you need to do this very, very fast. And there's a couple of concepts of how we're currently, you know, somewhere between basic science to maybe applied science, what we're currently thinking about how this would work. And in fact, a couple of technologies in small organs does work. One is, for example, nano-rewarming, where you have like small magnetic, ferromagnetic particles, metal particles, and you put them into a magnetic field, and then the magnetic field changes, and then all these particles wobble around, and they generate basically energy by friction in the end, right? And by a couple more other effects. Like, and then there's like a concept of ultrasound rewarming, where you have like targeted ultrasound beams that all have a different focal length, where you can target different parts of the brain, different depths of the brain at the same time. So, but all of these concepts are, they work in small volumes. And now, again, coming back to the engineering challenges, they would need to be scaled up to then be usable for larger amounts. This is why I'm, at least compared to the longevity field, a bit more optimistic. Because technically, you know, just scaling something up, I'm not saying it's easy, but it's easier. So this is kind of why we're, where we're coming from and why I think this could be, comparatively easier than figuring out biology.
Hopefully not impossible if you've been able to do it on a small scale, and the fact that you're even able to successfully reduce someone's temperature and cryopreserve them. Imagine that 100, 200 years ago. You know, So there's no necessarily with that logic, there's kind of a very relatively high probability of it being able to be figured out.
I think at some point, I don't see any reason why this shouldn't work at some point. Like, I mean, we could in theory find there could be a new theory of consciousness that like includes some part that somehow, I don't know, what we would almost call metaphysical right now, right? Like unknown unknowns that, but currently there seems to be no evidence pointing in that direction. Like all these, you know, quantum theory of consciousness is not really, definitely it's a, you know, doesn't have consensus support or anything like that. So it seems to be that this is, you know, just an engineering problem, not an easy engineering problem, but just an engineering problem that will just be solved at some point. And hopefully a lot of people who are signed up for cryopreservation, you know, will be solved fast enough so that they can benefit from it.
Yeah. And how do you decide who's the first person to get tested on fully? Because, you know, it might work in the future, but I guess it's got to be patient zero for the rewarming process. What do you think about that?
Right. So you wouldn't test on people who signed up to be, you know, to live in the future. So there's a couple of things, right? So let's say in the future, we can do it in animals, right? In pigs or whatever, it works, right? At that point, initially, you would probably, just like you do today, you would ask people who is willing to donate their body to science. People who don't care about cryopreservation at all. There is always going to be people who don't care about this. Right, and they just are down to donate their body so that scientific progress can be made just like they do today. So there you would try. And then at some point, you probably will get good enough so that in some cases it works, where you can actually bring people back. And so I think it's morally not okay to bring people back if they have not chosen to be wanted to brought back, right? It should be very much a personal choice. So I think in that stage, you would have people who would say, I'm willing to donate my body, and if it works, that's great, and if it doesn't work, that's also great. And of course, you would have very comprehensive and, you know, informed consent, and of course, based on whatever the legal system would be in the future, difficult to predict as well, but you would have very, like, they would really like decide based on like having all the information, just like you do today for a clinical trial, where stuff is being tested, where we don't exactly know how it works, but and if it will work, or maybe it even has downsides, right? But people do it with consent. And then at some point you would say, yes, now we can do it. Now we know how to do this. We have run all these clinical trials, right? If people sign up for cryopreservation, they can currently say, do you rather want to be woken up as early as possible or later? So you would start with those people where, and when I say start, like, so I think the risk profile of bringing someone back from cryopreservation should be somewhere in the range of a large-scale operation right now, where we can do them, but they still have risks, right? And of course, now the trick or the interesting thing to think about is, at the time when we can bring people back, we will likely have perfected the procedure of cryopreservation so much that if something goes wrong, or like it deviates from the ideal conditions during warm-up, you would just stop, go back, wait another 20 years or for whatever, right? And wait until we have new technology that makes this procedure even better, where then we can maybe whatever problem arose, we can now fix that. And, yeah. And then last but not least, it would likely be a procedure where it would be last in, first out, right? The people who have been cryopreserved with the best technology would be woken up first because there would be the least amount of complexity, the least amount of damage, the best cryoprotective agent. So what we tell our people who sign up for cryopreservation is, like, no one should do cryopreservation. A, we wouldn't do it. And B, it makes no sense to want to do this early. You should live, you know, live as healthy as possible, as long as possible, and then just do it as a last-ditch effort so that we have the most possible amount of time to perfect the cryopreservation procedures. And of course, it's an active research field, an active development field, so it's going to get better and better. So wait the longest possible amount of time, then do it. So I think this is how you tentatively would do this in the future regarding warming up and then waking people up.
Yeah, and when you're warming people up, obviously you have to do that successfully. But then do you also have to, I assume, depending on the illness and stuff, like revive them or resuscitate them, or would that be part of the process as well? Or is it a separate process?
It would be part of the process. So most likely, and again, everything I'm saying about the far future is speculative. During the warm-up procedure, at some point you would get into where the cryoprotective agent becomes liquid again. Like, you know, even at minus degrees, because it's a cryoprotective agent, it's actually liquid during, or like it's high viscosity, but liquid. So at that point, you would already start curing. Again, let's keep with the cancer example. You would start curing the cancer with whatever technology there will be in the future. You would fix all the, you might fix old body, like fix whatever we call old bodies right now, you know, misfolded proteins, damage in like, you know, all these things, you would fix them. And then the once now you have warmed up and you have replaced all the cryoprotective agent against some, that would be a synthetic blood or whatever, you would likely just do what we currently do. You would start recirculation, you would shock the heart into rhythm, and then you would provide oxygen, and then most of the cells are made, if they get oxygen, if they get nutrients and so on, they're kind of made into, you know, they start just start working again. And then, you know, it's not like if someone and someone's heart stops, it's not like you need to restart the brain, right? The brain also, it basically sinks it back into rhythm, kind of. Right, the heart you need to shock to sink it into rhythm, but of course you can do this with current technology. And then probably the people will just start. It just starts working all again, and potentially right now, if a part doesn't work, it might be too damaged to repair. At least imaginable that you can do 3D printing of organs almost right now, not yet right now, but 100 years in the future, it's probably gonna be child's play. So let's say the kidney has gotten too much damage. Okay, cool. Then we just 3D print a kidney. And of course, this sounds like, oh, it's like very, very simple. And it's, of course, nowhere near as simple. But it's also not unimaginable. So I think this would be kind of how we would go about this.
Yeah. It's just so cool how we're on the edge of this kind of almost innovative, like, revolution, in a way, because we're so close. Nanotechnology is improving, cryopreservation is improving, artificial intelligence is improving, all these things that could potentially increase our lives to almost like an infinite amount. It's just incredible. I just don't, if you told someone 100 years ago that this was possible, it just probably would blow their minds completely. I mean, it's blowing my mind already, just understanding how close we are to all these different things. And in terms of AGI and super intelligence, the singularity, nanotechnology, it seems like all of these different kind of separate fields could combine to create something really special. How long do you think it is until we reach super intelligent AI and super advanced nanotechnology? And how do you think that could affect like cryopreservation and rewarming and reviving people in your field?
If we achieve real, what we would call real super AI, then everything else, nanotech, revival from cryopreservation, is, if humanity and the world and the universe still exists, and it's not like, the nightmare scenario of non-aligned AI, right? Then it's probably all pretty shortly downstream from that. Right? If we have real, like what we, like, you know, the past really called super AI, a million times more intelligent, more agentic than humans, then probably the rest is going to be solved pretty quick. So I personally work under the assumption that, so my probability that super AI will be around anytime soon, it might not be super long, but my distribution of how long it might take is pretty wide. So it could very well be that, again, like, I think usually these fields are too optimistic about how fast progress goes. We thought decades ago that we're just around the corner from AI, right? And then now, of course, with the transformer infrastructure and so on, people think that again. But I'm not as convinced. And also my personal, I don't know enough about, I'm not an AI researcher, nor do I have the pedigree to become one. So for me, I operate under the assumption that it might take longer than it will. In the meantime, we're using all the, whatever narrow AI we can use, we're going to use it for research and so on. So under the assumption that super AI does not come about, let's say there's a fundamental problem why this can't be done, which I'm not aware of any, but let's assume, then I think like the sufficiently advanced technology might take a good amount of time. Then we're back to my, 50 to 100 year horizon.
Yeah, I was just going to ask about your entrepreneurial kind of era. Didn't you found and make some startups and exit a few of them? Could you tell me a bit more about that?
Right, yeah. So I studied medicine initially to go into longevity. Longevity was always my motivation and all of the above, right? So so this is why I went into this field. I switched to startups because I didn't really find something that I felt like is valuable enough to do. So the startups were basically a stopgap measure, right? Like to do something and get the ropes of learning to run companies. So I ran one data analysis company and a medtech company and digital health company. Those two I sold. But it was basically biding my time to do something in longevity. And then in 2019, I started actually, contemplating what to do. And then I started a nonprofit foundation that does research in the field of cryopreservation. And then Tomorrow Bio, that I'm now running with Fernando, my co-founder, that actually does like the cryopreservation day-to-day, day-to-day cryopreservation. So the other companies were just, they were there to make the most money the quickest as possible, right? To then have the mental freedom and the bandwidth to do cryopreservation stuff.
Yeah. And what would your advice be for kind of young entrepreneurial minded people that aren't sure what they really want to do? And what are some tips that you've used yourself to figure out what you kind of want to do with your life? Because you've pivoted a few times, so you clearly have a lot of experience in stopping.
I didn't pivot. So I think for me, this was always very easy. Like, so since I'm 18 or 17 or 16 even, like my goal is to not die and then to enjoy life. Not saying I don't enjoy a holiday on the beach or in the mountains or whatever, right? So, but the primary, so basically it's like, I'm driving a car and there's a wall and I'm driving, towards that wall, and that wall, which is like, the 85-year-old dying, me dying, that is my primary concern.
Yeah.
I can do as many beaches and, thereafter, once that is figured out. So for me, it technically was never a pivot. So it just how to reach that changed.
Yeah.
So it was initially, again, I went into med school to do research science in longevity. Then I did as much research as I could. Okay. As doing research, I got a better understanding how slow research is. So I thought, hey, I can't stay in academia. I need to, go the company path. Didn't know what to do at that point. So I said, hey, let's learn how to build startups in general. And now I'm doing what I actually want to do, right? But none of these things were technically pivots. And I think this is kind of what, if you don't know yet, I think spend a tremendous amount of time to figure out what you actually want to do. I think there's way too many people who, wake up when they're 35 and they're in consulting or investment banking or whatever the fuck. And suddenly they're like, fuck, this is not really, if you're in med school teaches you and puts you on a track to become a private practice doctor or become a doctor in a hospital.
Yeah.
If you're in computer science, you're on track to, maybe sometimes start a startup, but also, become a programmer in a large corporation. Like, if you're in business school, you're being taught to go into consulting or investment banking or something like that, right? So you're on these very clear tracks, and usually people are being put on those tracks before they ever sat down and thought about, what do I really want to do? Right? Because you're in high school, right? And then the universities come and say, listen, why don't you study this? And when you're in university, the McKinsey's and BCG's and whatever come and say, hey, listen, we want to come to our great dinner, and maybe you can later on join us. So I think the only and biggest advice is really to think about what you want to do. And then make it a conscious decision that this is what you want to do. And based on that conscious decision, then, pick your path and go for that.
And yeah, very, very good.
I think this is the only, and I always knew, but I just currently right now, every year, every 2 years or whatever, I sit down and think if what I'm doing is still the best path of to what I want to do. Right. So it's one level below that kind of. So first you need to figure out what you want to do. And then second level is to always reevaluate, is that what you're doing based on your skill set and what you've learned and so on, is this still the best path? And again, that's why I switched away from research and so on, because I think it was the right decision. I still believe that it's the right decision. I switched away from this. Yeah.
Mm. Very, very good advice, and definitely something I'll take note of, kind of the idea of deciding what to do. You don't have to stick with it, you know?
And I think the trick is to make it a conscious decision. Right, because it always feels like the easy path is, you know, to go from high school to university, from university to start a job, and then you kind of in this machine. And then once you join the consulting company, you know, and you're a skillful person, then the path is now to become partner, right? And that path is the easy path. It might be a lot of work, but it's you're not taking much risk. Like, people tell you how to do it, and you just need to stay in your lane, basically. But this might very well not be the thing that you actually would have wanted to do. And so I think this is feels like a lot of people don't do this enough. And without actively thinking about it, I also wouldn't do enough about it. So I kind of make it an active exercise to reevaluate that relatively regularly. Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. People spend more time thinking about what they're going to wear on the weekend to the nightclub than they do on the course they choose or the job they decide to go down. Do you think it's almost like an avoidant psychological tactic because it feels like so much energy and so scary? Like, oh, I don't know what to do in my life.
And it is scary, right? Like, figuring out that it's a bit of a like sunken cost fallacy kind of thing, right? Like, you put that much time already into your whatever career, and now switching away from it and might all be for nothing. Like, in hindsight, I should definitely not have studied men's. Like, I mean, you never know, right? Like, I mean, it could be that I would be someone totally else if I wouldn't have, but it feels like I spend a good amount of time on things that I definitely don't need at all right now. And so I think that, and then it's also, again, it's like, you know, if you've always been an employee and then you figure out you should run a company, it's still a scary thought. Like, it's something that is like a thing that you don't have experience and you don't know how to do and so on. So I totally get that this is not an easy thing, but I think it's still necessary or the right thing.
Hmm. And what was the mindset you had when you were doing these new things that you hadn't done before and you weren't maybe too sure about what you were doing? Did you learn through action or through mentoring?
Yeah, for me, it was unfortunate. So it's not like I don't have like great advice, because it was always relatively easy. So I while I was in med school, I was running a tech company with an old high school friend of mine. So the jump was pretty easy, right? Mm. Now, I run a longevity company, but it's also technically a company, right? And since I ran a few companies before, if it's now a longevity company or a different company, it's not that much of a jump. So I never, even though it sounds like it, for me, it was never cold water jumps. It was I'm in med school, but now I just had anyway a company running in the weekend and in the evenings. So I just scaled down the going to the research lab and scaled up going to, you know, running the company, right? And then it was always kind of like more softer transitions. I'm not saying they were not without any like more abrupt changes, but it was not like this, you know, this is totally wrong and I've never done anything, so I need to take this pretty deep jump now. It was never like that.
Mm. And do you think that's also because you were genuinely following something you were passionate about? Because if it was something that you didn't like, it would be maybe a colder jump for you. Do you think the passion helped a lot in that process?
It definitely does. It definitely does. I mean, to be fair, this is the first company where I really have a passion for. To be fair, the research I also had really a passion during med school. Because back then I thought this is the path, right? So there I also spent tremendous amounts of time on the weekend in the lab and so on, because I thought this is the path. The companies in the meantime, they were mostly like, they were there to make money, but it's not really something that super motivates me much. So for me, there's much of a difference in regards to motivation now than there was ever in the past. So there's definitely a difference. Yeah.
Hmm. And have you got any, we spoke about indifference earlier, right? With cryopreservation in general, but did you get any kind of criticism or kind of weird opinions and looks from family and friends when you were kind of pivoting into cryonics, or was everyone very supportive of you?
Way less than I thought. So initially, right, we thought, listen, like, there's going to be a couple of friends who say, hey, listen, don't call me anymore. This has not happened at all. I mean, my family, to be fair, was always very supportive of everything and so on. And also from our friends groups. No, this has never been an issue. And not only within friends, but also in the broader community. We thought initially that we're going to have significantly more, I don't know, people who are, I don't know, annoyed at us or like getting something, need to handle like negative press all day long. None of this has happened. Most people, like the overwhelming majority, there are people out there who say this is not for me, but that's totally fine, right? And also I have a lot of friends who say this is not for me, but that's totally fine. It's not something that someone needs to do. It's something that someone, it should be the individual's choice, but it should also be very well the choice to say this is not for me, right? So yeah, none of that has ever materialized and has been there. Yeah,
it always seems like our brain thinks that there's going to be so much criticism and like raining down on us, and then you end up doing it, and then everyone's like, "Oh, that's cool," or "Oh, that's not for me." Like, why?
Absolutely.
Why does that happen though? Is it just an evolutionary thing? Do you think? Just like,
yeah, I think it's always easy to kind of stuff that is not normal, as in everybody does it, no moral weight. But I think this. Something that is not done regularly is always put into the category of maybe this shouldn't be done, right? And there was a time when we didn't do heart transplantations, right? There was a time when we didn't fly. Like the first people flying across the Atlantic, this was probably scary to people, and everybody was like, "Oh my God," right? And now it's priced in, and everybody does it all day long almost, right? Same with heart transplantations. This was super considered pretty weird, taking a heart from one human, putting it into another human, right? Now, no one would want to miss it. So I think it's relatively easy to put not common together with this is not okay, this shouldn't be done, this is against nature, or whatever criticism some people say. But I think this is a fallacy. These things might be correlated, but they're definitely not causative. So there's a lot of stuff that we will do in 100 years from now, that will be absolutely standard, that is unimaginable right now. And so I think that the point always comes down to that, of course, in my moral worldview, it is the individual's choice. It's not like cryopreservation is hurting anybody. It's not like it's costing anybody but yourself money, right? It's not on some social security system that needs to pay for this, which, by the way, I would also not support. So it is your own money. It's your decision. You make that call for yourself. And I see no reason why someone should not be able to make that call for themselves.
Mm. And the limited amount of times I've spoken to people about this, or I've been like, "Oh, I'm getting this person who's into cryopreservation." They look at me like, "What's that?" And then I explain to them what it is. So a few people have been like, "Oh, well, what about overpopulation? And what about the climate and stuff?" So what's your kind of snapback to that argument?
Yeah, the snapback is that, first of all, like, if any indication, if the predictions are correct, right, we're going to level out somewhere around 13 billion, about somewhere between, I don't know, 11 to 13, right? If we have two more technology, if you have vertical farming and fusion reactors, a lot of these problems go away. With fusion reactors, we can desalinate water. With vertical farming, we can make as much food as we want, right? The world doesn't have a space problem. It has a distribution problem, right? There's so many areas, even in Germany and Europe, which is a very densely populated area, where there's no one, right? So, you could have your own, you don't even like me to see anybody. The point is, we all live in cities, right? There's other cities that don't have enough food and water because they're all, and so on. And then the second point is, so I think this is not a realistic thought. There was a time when overpopulation was discussed, right? When we had, I don't know, 2 billion people living on the earth, right? So this is, I think it's always just feels like it. We're going to find technologically solutions. And here we even know what the technological solutions are. And fingers crossed, fusion reactors this time around are actually not always 10 years in the future, but actually will come about. And then I think on the other point, I think that's more like a moral point, is, let's say there would even be a population problem, or a potential, there's a chance that there would be a population problem. I think it is not our right to say someone needs to die. Let's say cryopreservation works, and there might be a population problem if everybody does cryopreservation. I think it would not be our right to say someone needs to die for the chance to avoid a population problem. We would need to now sit together as a society and stop buying our second Porsche and our second house and whatever, and figure this out, how we can solve this problem as society. But it would not, I think that it is not an acceptable solution that you would say, and implicitly people saying that, implicitly is people saying, hey, if they say, hey, cryopreservation, but what about population? Implicitly, they're saying that someone might not be allowed to live as long as medically possible because of potential overpopulation problems.
Mm. And isn't depopulation more of a problem or potential problem than overpopulation now?
In some regions, definitely. Europe, most European countries are shrinking. Yeah. Like Germany and other countries and also the US, we're not at replacement rate anymore or just about. And more countries, the wealthier they get, who currently might still have enough children to at or above replacement rate, the more wealthy they get, the trajectory is usually good to go under replacement rate. So I think this idea of, there's a couple of these high-level criticisms that the second you discuss them a bit, they fall apart pretty quick. They're like gut reactions almost. Mm-hmm. Like their gut reactions, don't we have enough people? And now in some regions we might, but in other regions we probably don't. Like a good amount of countries know that they need to bring in people from abroad because otherwise they will not have enough, not to speak of social security systems, right? Where we don't have enough young people to pay for all the older people, right? So I think this is not a, it's not an issue. I think that the two main moral issues that I see with this topic is that you need to make sure that there's informed consent, that people do know what they're signing up for. Most importantly, that we can't say if and when it will work. And then B, it is not okay that cryopreservation is currently so expensive that some people who want to do it cannot afford it. We haven't had that problem. We always found a way how to do it. So even for people who don't have the money, you know, we find a way, but at scale, we might not be able to do that, right? Mm. So one of the goals of the company is to bring the cost down, right? As make it better, make it more accessible, meaning more teams and more coverage. But then last but not least, make it more affordable so that it is not a choice that comes down to personal wealth, but just a choice down to, do you want to do it?
Yeah. And you mentioned kind of the example where you somehow made it possible for someone who couldn't afford it right now to be able to afford it. Could you go into a bit more or elaborate a bit more about that? What did you do to make it possible?
Yeah, so there's a couple of ways how to do that. So none of them is like super ideal, but it's the best what we can currently do. So you can just do the brain preservation. You don't preserve the whole body, you just preserve the brain for the chance that in the future with organ 3D printing and so on, everything but the brain is not unique. So most likely, at least in theory, it can be replaced in the future. Then there are some people who, under certain, if someone really can't afford it, who have historically donated to fund that cryopreservation. No guarantee at all, doesn't work always and so on. And then there are some ways how you can do more affordable cryopreservations where the quality might be a bit lower. We would always make sure that you understand that, but where it can be done a bit more affordable. None of these are great options so far, but we're working on finding better ones and making it more affordable if need be.
Mm. And just going back to the depopulation thing or the overpopulation thing, right? When people say we were able to rewarm and revive people, surely more brains there are on Earth increases the probability of overpopulation and depopulation being solved. You know, the more people, the more brains there are. And also, if Mars colonization in the future becomes a possibility, that might also take some pressure off Earth's population anyway. So,
And we wouldn't even need Mars, right? We can have floating cities. We can have cities in, you know, if we just increase the population density like we have in New York, all of the world, right? We're not going to have any amount of, you know, there's regions like hundreds of thousands of square mile or kilometers, right? Where there's no one living. Right. Yeah. So if we just increase population density to the higher population like densities, right? You know, if someone has ever flown from, you know, the west coast of the US to the east coast of the US or vice versa, you fly over areas of land where there is nothing, right? So in theory, if you have sufficient energy, you live there, right? You know, you get water from desalination from the sea, right? And then you would be able to live there. So I think it's not an issue that is borne out in reality, or like at least assuming that we will have these technologies relatively soon. It's not something that we shouldn't think of, but it's definitely not something where I would say, you know, and we always need to remember, right? Let's say I have a million people cryo preserved, right? At this time, we have done very well. A million people in the future, in addition, that's less than 0.1%.
Yeah,
it's nothing. It's negligible, right? And even if we would have a billion people cryo preserved, you know, that would be less than 10% extra people. So it's likely just not an issue.
Agreed. Definitely agreed. And how does your company differ from other cryopreservation companies, maybe like companies such as Alcor and US companies?
Yeah, so there's a couple of points. So on one hand, as I already said, we're growing much, much faster. So I think we have an easier way to sign up. I think we communicate the topic probably a bit better. We of course have more teams in the world, right? Like we have European teams. Initially, we started this organization because we said, hey, you know, if you live in Europe, if you want to be cryopreserved here, there is no one doing this. Technically, other organizations cover Europe, but they don't have teams here and so on. Now we also do cover the US. So we cover Europe and the US. We do what is called whole body field cryoprotection. So we do the procedure on site, which has advantages in quality. And then there's a long list of smaller things. Like on average, the CT scans that we have published over the last years just are on average better than what has been published by other organizations. On average, at least, and also, definitely in the last ones. So it's a long list of smaller things. The bigger things are a bit of a younger, more dynamic, improving faster, a strong focus on quality of preservation. Currently, we're the only ones who publish CT scans, which is, in my mind, one of the most important quality metrics post-preservation. Others want to start doing that or restart doing that. But so far, I don't think anything is published. So I would say it's logistics, it's quality, and trajectory of how fast the organization develops and gets better.
And what needs to be done and innovated for it to become much cheaper? You spoke about kind of reducing the costs. What do you think are the hurdles that you must overcome to make it cheaper?
The biggest factor by far is how many people sign up for cryopreservation. So a lot of the cost comes down that currently worldwide per year, maybe 40 to 50 people get cryopreserved. So if that number would go up, let's say to 1,000 per country, then you would be able to share the cost of the medical teams by much more, right? Storage costs would go down. A lot of the costs are just very, very dependent on how many people do it. So that's by far the highest cost. You could, in theory, find a way of how you improve the quality, the procedural quality, but probably that's not going to do that much. The biggest factor is how many people do it by far.
Is that economies of scale? Is that kind of the...
Yeah. That's by far, far the biggest factor.
And how big's like the... How many facilities do you have, and how big are your kind of storage facilities of these cryopreserved people at the moment, and where are they?
Right. So we currently only have one. In fact, cryopreservation facilities are, from everything we do, that's the easy part. So we have one in Switzerland. Switzerland, of course, a country that if you want to pick a country worldwide, Switzerland is probably a good bet.
Yeah.
We're thinking now about building a second one. Long term, I want to have multiple. Right? Long term, I want to have like one in America, in Asia, and like all geopolitical, to have geopolitical risk mitigation, pretty much. So we're thinking about building a second one, starting to build a second one soon. It's not a super high priority because everything else is more important. From a storage perspective, So in our Switzerland facility with expansion that we can do on the plot of land that we bought, we can now store about as many people, double the amount of people that have been cryopreserved in all of history together.
Wow.
So, which sounds very big, but also the number is not that high.
Yeah.
So, so storage is not going to be an issue in the end. So let's say we are at that capacity. So you can do like somewhere between 1,000 and 1,500 people there. Let's say you're at that capacity, right? Then you have enough money to just build another facility. Like facilities are comparatively affordable in the grand scheme of things.
Mm. And I've collected some common public questions or misconceptions about cryopreservation on the internet. We've covered a few of them, or maybe half spoken about them so far. So the first one is, we spoke about this one, is cryonics freezing people?
No, it's not. It's vitrifying people. So basically putting into a glass-like state.
Mm. And is cryonics only for the rich?
Yeah, no, rich, definitely no. You need a bit of money, but most people can fund it with life insurance. So on average, I think people who sign up with us pay around 70 euros per month.
Mm, that's not a lot. That isn't a lot at all, to be fair.
It's not at all, absolutely. Like, of course, if you're dying tomorrow, right, then it would be a one-time cost of 200. I think you can't do it with life insurance. So yeah, then it is a cost, right? But you can get it done if you start early, if you're relatively young and relatively healthy, and you take life insurance, and you can get it for reasonably affordable prices, so that almost everybody can afford it.
Yeah, I'm just wondering. This isn't a common public question. Has anyone that you kind of half know that isn't like a good friend that they try to like do a favor and be like, oh, can you get me cryopreserved for free? Like, you know, someone you just met and you told them your job, but they ever been like trying to get a favor from you?
No, I don't think anybody has said it. And honestly, we will shut it down. It's not even up to us. Like, so the storage of people in cryopreservation is an independent foundation that we started, but it's an independent foundation that is there to make sure that, you know, everybody is safe and sound. And if you would cryopreserve someone for free, everybody else who has been cryopreserved would pay for it. So you can't do that. Like, there always needs to be, everybody needs to pay for themselves, unfortunately.
Yeah. Well, it makes sense, doesn't it? Like, it'd be crazy for it not to be the case. The next question is cryonics a real science?
Yes, it is. It's falsifiable. You can not necessarily the fact that part, at least like the research experiments that are being done are falsifiable. There's hypothesis, there's data. Every part that makes science is there. Like, this idea that it might not have been like 30 years ago, it might have been more or less scientific, but these are things that are not the case anymore, if they ever were.
Next question: what happens if the cryonics company goes bankrupt?
For people in storage, nothing. So all the people in storage are always with non-profit foundations. And I think this is a very important factor. And this is the same for us. If we go out of business and we do everything to not go out of business and have a significantly more, you know, kind of conservative money management than you would normally in early stage companies or younger companies. But if we go out of business, nothing happens. Like, people stay in storage. It's all fine. Not saying, you know, we take that lightly or anything like that, but at least no one would go out of cryopreservation if that should that happen.
Yeah, and how would it be paid for if they were still being in storage and the company went bankrupt, and say it went bankrupt for a long time and no one swooped in?
That's one of the reasons why it's so expensive. So for everybody who gets cryopreserved, 120,000 euros are being put aside in a foundation in Switzerland.
Wow.
And they invest that money and pay for the annual maintenance of storage, keeping people in cryopreservation. They pay it out of the return. So as long as you can get somewhere between 0.1 to 1% above inflation in return, which historically you always could, even at low risks, you can maintain it. So we're not necessary. Like, the money is all independently in that foundation, or these foundations. So once you're in storage, tomorrow being around or not does not matter.
The more people know about stuff like this, the more people are going to sign up. Because
fingers crossed. Yeah, no, absolutely.
Yeah, this is crazy. This is like amazing. What's the largest organ or thing that's ever been fully revived from the dead?
So whole organism, it's C. elegans, the small worm that's being used in laboratory experiments. That's a model organism being used a lot. That you can fully cryopreserve. You can wake it up. It lives on. It keeps its memories and so on. I mean, it's worm memory, but still it's neurally encoded memory. It's pretty small, though, but it's the biggest organism that can fully be cryopreserved. Of course, you can do cells and all of that. That's pretty easy. And then for organs, it's a rabbit kidney.
Wow.
That you can, you know, you cryopreserve it, you transplant it back into an animal. It works. The animal survives. All is good. That you can also do.
That's amazing. Shows that this could really be possible. If a kidney.
Yeah. It's just a scaling problem.
Yeah. It seems that it's a scaling problem on the business side and the feasibility side right now. That's kind of the main problem, is getting the scale high enough on both those on the customer list and the innovation list.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
The next question, how do you preserve memories and personality if you're cryopreserved?
So as much as you currently understand, memories, personality, and all of it is the connections in the brain. The cells, the connections, the weight of those connections, and so on. So, and in cryopreservation, that stuff is just preserved. Right. So again, as much as we currently understand, as much as neuroscience currently understands, that would be preserved. So you don't need to do any specific. You just cryopreserve, you do it well, and then memories and so on would be preserved.
Hmm. And that kind of relates to the anesthetic, going on to anesthetic again, because it's like you don't have to figure out a new way to preserve memories and personality after you're under anesthetic. So hopefully it's a kind of similar thing.
Yeah, hopefully. Yeah, yeah. You just keep the stuff around that is required.
Yeah.
And that makes you you and makes me and makes everybody themselves. That stuff is just preserved.
Yeah, and surely the only way for it to go wrong is if it got damaged. That's like the one thing that's...
If it got damaged, right? I mean, theoretically, you might be able to repair some type of damage, but it's also imaginable that it's that you can have damage beyond repair. But that would be the idea, yeah.
Yeah. And the next question, has anyone who's been cryopreserved melted accidentally in the history of cryopreservation?
In the history, in the very early days, yes, because this was very much, you know, in the 1970s and so on. Right? This was really like a garage kind of non-professional thing. Not since this is all done by foundations and the structure that we currently have. So by now, all these organizations that I would say are relevant organizations, they have all been safe and sound.
Hmm. And how do you see cryonics evolving in the next 20 years?
So on one hand, be much, much bigger, right? Like, of course, quality will go up, more people will do it. And hopefully at least one big scientific breakthrough, as in, for example, being able to revive larger organs take them out of cryopreservation and potentially revive a mammal like a rat or a mouse. Definitely not an easy task by any means, but maybe within the realm of possibility.
Yeah. And some ending questions. I was going to ask if you were remembered for one thing, what would you be? But I think I should rephrase that and say, if you are known for one thing, what would it be? Because hopefully you're going to live forever.
Well, hopefully, yeah. But so for now, I'm known for cryopreservation. Like, this has been my jam, right? This has been my thing that I've talked probably the most about. And I think I'm now, for better or for worse, the cryo guy if I'm showing up at some conference, which I don't mind at all. I'm happy to be that. I guess that's that.
Yeah, yeah. And if you had one piece of advice for your 20-year-old self, what would it be?
20-year-old, I was in med school. I think my advice is always like, you know, even for me, like, you know, we talked before, like, you know, do bigger jumps. I think for me, it would have been every time I felt like something is scary or new, like, I think it's usually not as scary as you think. You can make, what I'm trying to live now is like, if I feel like there's difficult decisions and where I feel like, oh my God, I don't know if I can do this, just be more optimistic about that. It probably will work out. So you know, when I'm 20, I would say, you know, start more companies, start them quicker, be more risk-taking in the end. As long, and this is the small caveat here, as long as you have a good downside protection, right? So I'm a doctor, right? It's like, if I if everything goes horrible, I just go to a hospital and say, here I am, and I probably can find a job and pay my rent and so on. So I think everything I'm saying depends on if you're lucky and have this downside protection, that if everything goes horribly wrong, you can still fall back on something, and then you have money to pay your rent and your food and all of that, which of course is a necessity.
Yeah, and I guess that's a way to do that is building transferable and solid skills that people benefit from, like you said about being
absolutely
a doctor. Yeah,
in the end, it is right. Have some marketable, skill, and then once you have that, then you can take all the risks that you want, because you can always, like, what's the worst that can happen, basically?
Yeah, 100%. And what advice would you give to someone who's literally just about to leave college and is smart, driven, and entering the real world?
Yeah, like what I elaborated a bit before in short words, right? Like, really think about if the trajectory that you're currently on is the thing that you really want to do. If this is the deep intrinsic motivation you have, it just makes life so much easier if you're doing what you really want to do.
110% agree with that, Emil. What's been your most worthwhile investment of time, money, and energy? It might be a bit obvious, but it might be.
Well, cryo preservation, what I do, this is where most of my time, money, and everything goes into. So I think this is the most worthwhile thing.
100%. And speaking of like longevity, do you still do any day-to-day things to increase your lifespan?
Yeah, I very much believe in this. Like, listen, I also want to live as long as possible and then be cryopreserved last. So I do all the standard stuff, gym and sleeping and healthy eating and, a couple of supplements. And I don't do anything crazy because I don't think there's any good evidence for anything out of the ordinary working. But the standard stuff, the stuff that your grandparents would have already told you, those things are all I all try to do.
Yeah. And what supplements are you taking at the moment?
Stuff that has good evidence, omega-3, vitamin D, some fiber stuff, and there's a couple of things, like a multivitamin, and there's a couple of things that I think have enough evidence that at least they're not negative, probably positive.
Yeah. And in terms of diet, what things would you not recommend eating?
That's a long list, right? I would say, I think the Mediterranean diet has probably the best evidence, right? Not much meat, lots of vegetables and so on. The negative list is pretty long.
Yeah, true. Dr. Emil Kenzior, ladies and gentlemen. Emil, I really appreciate this conversation. And I think it's a much needed one that more society need to learn about and understand. And I need to stop cryocrastinating and sign up for it.
Absolutely. That's I can recommend. We say, if you make the decision that you want to do it, take as much time as you need to make the decision, yes or no. But once you've made it, then do it. We have a couple of people every year who do it and then they unfortunately die early. Even though statistically that's a low probability, right? Once you made that call, you're already down for to mitigate low probability risks or swinging for the fences. Yeah. So you might as well do it next week. And of course, we're more than happy to help. And so feel free to reach out at any point, and we're happy to help.
100% will do. What are you currently working on at the company, like the last 6 months to a year?
It's mostly growth and science always and logistics. And to be fair, I will probably say exactly the same in 10 years from now. I think this is it's a very long-term mission, and I think these things will hold true for a long time.
Good, good. And where can people go if they want to find your work?
So the best way for tomorrow is go to tomorrow.bio, our webpage, but also feel free to reach out to me on LinkedIn or any other online wherever you find me. We're usually pretty easy to reach. Sign up to our newsletter. There's always events that we invite our community to. So just reach out.
Brilliant. I'll leave the links to that in the show notes. Thank you, Emil. Really appreciate your time.
Thank you so much.
If you got to the end of this video, then you're literally in the top 1% of minds on the planet. You're curious, you love podcasts, and you love this show, but you also probably want to start your own show as well. And this is the exact same position I was in about a year or two ago, where I consumed so many podcasts and loved every second of it. But in the back of my mind, there was always that thought, I want to start my own show. But the problem was, all these podcasters that I listened to didn't have a step-by-step blueprint that would help me avoid the mistakes that they've made and create my own pro show like the ones that I listened to from them. in a fast amount of time. Luckily for you, I've solved this problem for you. I've created my step-by-step pro remote podcast blueprint for the kind of person who wants to start a podcast from scratch, but has no idea of what equipment to use, how to find guests, how to actually record it, even on their laptop if they live in the middle of nowhere and don't have a studio, which, let's be real, most of you probably don't have and you don't actually need, and want to grow their show fast, generate viral social media clips, and actually turn podcasting into not just a dream, but a genuine career that they can make money from. So if you're interested in this, it is literally a video course that goes through every single step and process that'll get you from no idea of how to start a show, no idea how podcasting works, to a pro remote podcaster who has the potential to generate viral social media clips and get their dream guests on their show in a matter of weeks. And as well as the video course, you'll also be able to join live weekly calls with me, where I'll go through your show and give you personalized feedback of how to improve to get you results much faster. You'll also get access to the AI email templates, the AI research templates, the title and thumbnail templates I use to get super high personality guests, super high performing guests, and at a really, really good conversion rate. A lot of the emails I send do end up getting yeses for people coming onto the show, as well as generate super engaging thumbnails and titles, and also generate viral social media clips. For example, one of my social media clips got 1 million+ views on Instagram and TikTok, the same clip. So this is proof that it works. And if you want to get all of this and genuinely become a pro podcaster super fast, even from your bedroom, then this is for you. And alongside my templates, you'll also get an ebook, which goes into even more detail about not just my show and how to create your own pro show, but also other successful shows and the tactics that they do to blow up on social media and generate a loyal audience that they can actually teach, but also make a career from as well. So if you're interested, then it's the first link in the description. You won't regret it. I know you've been dreaming of creating a podcast your entire life, or for at least a year, 6 months. And this is the best opportunity you're going to get. And I don't know any other pro podcaster that I listen to, that I love, that has a step-by-step blueprint of the exact things they do to grow and continue to succeed at their show. So this is the once-in-a-lifetime opportunity for you right now. It might have changed if you're watching this a few months later, but right now you can get the founder's pre-sale price. And basically, once 25 members join the community, the price will double. And also, if you don't feel satisfied with the course and with the community, and you have followed all the steps, taken all the notes, taken all the action, and if you don't feel like you're at least 5 times more confident at podcasting and don't have a remote pro show all set up and ready to get your dream guests on to your show and create a super awesome podcast, then I'll give you your money back, no questions asked. So if you're interested, first link in the description, your future self will thank you. I'll hopefully see you there. Goodbye. Hey guys, first of all, I want to say thank you. There's one person who's been sharing the podcast more than anybody else, and that is you. The only reason why this podcast continues to grow is because you are sharing it. And my only ask is, if this podcast has provided value to you, or you think it'll provide value to somebody else, then if you could send them a DM of the link or a screenshot to the show, that would genuinely make my day. And it's the only way the podcast will continue to grow. That's my only ask of you. Thank you very much.